Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our guest is award-winning columnist and author Robert J. Samuelson. Robert has written a column for the Washington Post since 1977 and for Newsweek since 1984. He has also authored several books, including his most recent work, The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Influence. Robert, welcome to our show.
Bruce, thank you very much for having me.
In discussing the similarities between the Great Depression and the Great Inflation, you write, "What ultimately governed their decisions was the conventional wisdom of the time. The policies had been set with egos at stake. They were presumed to be correct." Going back to the 60s, what was the conventional wisdom at the time in regards to how you create a healthy economy?
The conventional wisdom in the 60s was what we now call, and what they call then, Keynesianism.
Okay.
After John Maynard Keynes, the famous British economist who died in 1946. And essentially, what Keynesianism amounted to was that professional economists had conquered the business cycle. They had figured out how to forecast the economy. They had the tools, they thought, to regulate the economy so that when they saw it coming, a recession coming, they could counteract it, and they could maximize economic growth, keep unemployment very low at what was called then full employment, and essentially give us a kind of endless prosperity because economics had become a kind of engineering process. And that was the reigning wisdom of the day.
And what was the Phillips curve?
The Phillips curve was named after an economist, an Australian economist, A.W. Phillips, who postulated that, seemed to show, that there was a fixed trade-off between higher inflation and lower unemployment, so that you could, in a social sense, pick what you thought was the most desirable mix of unemployment and inflation. So if you wanted a lower unemployment, say 4% or 3%, you would have to tolerate somewhat higher inflation, say 4 or 5%. But that these relationships were fixed, and so you could pick the sort of the menu that you wanted, and then you could arrange your policy to produce it.
Walter Heller was chairman of Kennedy's Council of Economic Advisors at the time, and I remember in your book you said that that Kennedy was a person that he actually really listened to his advisors. And so was that part of the situation where the economic thought of the time really was played out as policy?
Well, it became played out as policy for two reasons. One is that Kennedy, although he was a practical politician, I mean, he'd been elected senator, he'd been elected to Congress, and then to the Senate, and then the presidency, he was open to new ideas. And his economists, his Council of Economic Advisors, which consisted of three academic economists led by Walter Heller from the University of Michigan, argue that the policies that Eisenhower had followed in the 1950s were really behind the times. And although the 50s had been a very prosperous decade, there had been three recessions, one very severe, one beginning just after the end of the decade, but really sort of part of the Eisenhower legacy. And Heller argued that economists knew more. They could prevent these recessions, and they could keep unemployment lower than it had been and maximize economic growth. And Kennedy at first was a skeptic. He had been raised with conventional ideas, and the conventional ideas of his youth and early adulthood was that the government should balance its budget and inflation was a bad thing. And what Heller and his associates were telling Kennedy was that you could use deficits, federal budget deficits, to kind of manipulate the economy. And even if a little bit more inflation resulted, it wasn't such a bad thing because you would have lower unemployment and the inflation wouldn't get out of hand and people would adjust to it. During the first couple of years of Kennedy's presidency, the economy didn't perform very well, and so Kennedy was open to something that would make it perform better. so he could be reelected in 1964. But he was also genuinely intellectually curious, and these ideas that Heller sold him really were very much in the mainstream and were embraced by economists, most economists, not all economists, but most economists at most universities, including the very most prestigious universities, the Ivy League.
Well, what ended up being wrong with these ideas or conclusions? What went wrong?
Well, the theory was wrong, essentially.
Okay.
There was no stable trade-off between inflation and unemployment. So that if you tried to maintain unemployment too low, instead of getting a fixed rate of inflation, which might have been tolerable, you got an ever-accelerating rate of inflation. And as a result, the inflation, which at the beginning of the 60s when Kennedy became president, was negligible. It was really between 1 and 2%, and it was very, very low. By the end of the 60s, it was 6%, and by the end of the 70s, it was 13% and 14%. Meanwhile, the fact that you had this rising inflation made the economy less stable rather than more stable. And so we had, between the end of the 60s and the early 1980s, four recessions of increasing severity. The recession of the early 80s had an unemployment rate, a peak unemployment rate of 10.8%. So the net result of this economic experiment was that everything it promised turned out to be exactly the opposite. It promised stable inflation. We didn't get stable inflation. It promised fewer business cycles and recessions. We got more business cycles and more recessions. It promised lower average unemployment. We got higher average unemployment. So it was a complete failure in almost every respect.
Which would lead me to ask this question. Is that thesis then off the table forever, or is it raising its head again? The idea that you can have...
Well, I think perhaps the most elaborate expressions of Keynesianism have been discredited. But the general idea seems to be enjoying a resurgence. Yes. The chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, a man named Olivier Blanchard, he's French, but he teaches at MIT, recently put out a paper saying, well, maybe a little bit of higher inflation is okay. And my reaction to this was, haven't they learned anything in the last 50 years? I think in the desperate position we were in at the end of 2008, and the beginning of 2009, the economic stimulus program, in theory, was desirable. I don't think it was executed and designed particularly well. But to try to prevent the economy was in the process, in my view, of falling off a cliff, and to kind of drag it back from the edge, it seems to me was desirable. But the idea that you can manipulate the business cycle and you can essentially avoid most downturns, at least cushion them, it seems to me is ultimately self-defeating. And we have to intervene, but we should be more restrained in our interventions, because our interventions, when they initially succeed, as they did in the 60s, and they did really at the end of the 90s and early part of this century, they create conditions which boomerang on us, and as a result, we got a terribly unstable economy in the 1970s, and we're now just dragging ourselves out of a big ditch, which was probably avoidable.
Robert, if you wanted to make a formula for creating inflation, what are the ingredients?
Well, first, I think the most important ingredient. And I didn't think this 4 or 5 years ago, but I do now. I think the most important ingredient is you don't care about it. Oh. You don't think it's important to keep the money relatively stable and sound. That this old-fashioned idea of sound money as a responsibility of government, it seems to be ancient history, a kind of a relic of the barbarian past. That, I think, is the loss of responsibility, I think, is very important, no matter how it is justified. Because once that happens, people begin concocting all sorts of apparently and superficially sophisticated ideas to justify doing something which in the end turns out to be very stupid. So I think that the mindset and mentality of decision makers and the public, to be fair, is very important. And I would say it's the most important thing. After that, I would say creating too much money and credit that's too easy and too loose is a precondition for most sustained inflations. You can have easy credit and easy monetary policy and expansive money supply and not get inflation if there are other things offsetting the monetary stimulus, and that's our situation today.
Okay.
But if you have a situation where the people in charge really don't care about inflation and they're willing to let things go, it seems to me you're preordained to get higher inflation.
Fortunately, we have the luxury of having two segments with you, so I'm going to go back to that topic in the second segment. You mentioned in your book the learning curve of successive presidents and their advisors was remarkably flat, and I found that very interesting, that you could have the brightest people in the world in charge of something, and there wasn't a progressive learning curve. The mistakes were replicated even if the presidency changed hands. So it raised this question. What role did politics play in swaying the economic policy in the 70s?
Well, I would say it was politics in a kind of intellectual sense. So what happened in the 1960s is that the economists persuaded the politicians and the political leaders that it was possible to have, as I mentioned earlier, sustained economic growth with few, if any, recessions and low unemployment perpetually. And once those ideas were accepted by the political leaders, they became part of the sort of the fabric of people's expectations. And that's what the government was promising. And so when these goals were not realized, there was a political backlash. And you would have people jumping up and saying, well, we have other ideas to achieve the same end. So rather than attacking the source of the problem, which was inflation and poor economic ideas, they kept essentially embroidering on bad policies. And they tried to, or to use another metaphor, they tried to prop up a structure that was collapsing. And every time they tried to prop it up, they would kind of do so for a few months or a year or two, and then the structure would begin to collapse again. And in that sense, there was no learning curve. The presidents and their closest advisors weren't willing to sort of step up and tell the public, what we told you we could do, we cannot do. And if we continue trying to do it, things will just continually get worse. And they just weren't able to do that, I guess for obvious reasons, but ultimately it fell to Ronald Reagan and Paul Volcker to deliver the harsh news that the promises that had been made could not be fulfilled.
Arthur Burns was the Fed chairman during, 70 to 78. And what would you say was his biggest mistake?
I think he was 70 to 79, but I'd have to go
okay.
back and check. But he was the Fed chairman. And Arthur Burns, for those among your listeners who don't know, was an eminent economist from Columbia University. He had been the head of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is, as the name implies, the major group, scholarly group of economic researchers in the country, and he was a very well-respected economist. And his major mistake was that he, although he was originally a skeptic of the kind of Keynesian promise, he kind of bought into it. And once he bought into it, he didn't realize that he didn't take the actions he needed to take to keep inflation under control, because he said that there were too many political pressures preventing him from doing that.
You had a sentence in the book that was great. It says, what was politically convenient was also rationalized intellectually. And that must have been the process that he went through. He didn't feel empowered enough to do what he thought he needed to do. And he was just swayed by political pressures. Is that fair to say?
Well, it was not just pressures, which he got from Nixon, who appointed him, but it was also just the political climate.
okay.
in which the Federal Reserve was expected to basically fulfill or help the government fulfill these goals of very low unemployment and constant economic growth and no business cycles. And what would happen is that they would ease credit and allow the money supply to expand, and you would get a burst of growth and you would get higher inflation. And at some point, then, the Fed would get very nervous about the rising inflation, so they would slam on the brakes and tighten credit and reduce growth of the money supply, and then the economy would slow down or go into recession, and they get upset about that, and they reverse the process. So you had this kind of herky-jerky policy, stop-go policies all during the 1970s, when the Fed really couldn't decide what it was supposed to do, and ended up doing nothing of a constructive way.
In your book, you mentioned the term expectation of inflation, and really that becomes almost as important as the inflation itself.
Can you? I think it's absolutely important, and I changed my mind about this during the course of writing this book. I mean, I thought it was important when I started writing the book, but I didn't think it was the most important thing. But my view is now that if you have expectations of higher inflation, you will get higher inflation.
And it's because what do we do that's different then?
Because businesses and workers just act in ways that produce it. The businesses feel that they can pass on any cost increases in higher prices, and workers assume that they can get higher salaries to reflect their higher cost of living. And you just get a wage price spiral, and unless the government steps in and stops it and also, in effect, announces it one way or another that it's simply not going to permit this kind of inflationary psychology, it's all self-fulfilling. It's an interesting example of this, I think. At the end of World War II, there was a huge burst of inflation because during the war, we had wage price controls, and so a lot of wage and price increases had been legally and artificially suppressed. And as soon as the controls came off, there was a huge burst of inflation. But it did not become self-fulfilling. We did not get double-digit inflation in the late 40s or early 50s or even during the entire period of the 50s. And I asked myself, why is it that that did not happen? And it wasn't because policy became really oppressive in the late 1940s and sort of stomped out the inflation. In my view, the main reason we didn't get that is people didn't expect it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That once they had kind of caught up to the events that had happened during the war, wage and price behavior went back to something more normal. And it's because people at that point just did not think that a country like the United States was going to have double-digit inflation forever. And so they didn't act that way. But by the end of the 1970s, when successive governments had been inflating the economy and when leaders clearly were not determined to stop inflation, the people's psychology and their behavior was very, very different. And you just got inflation feeding on itself. But the major difference here were people's expectations.
By the end of the 70s, what were the expectations of the typical American family as looking to their future? How did inflation change their outlook?
First, they were scared.
They were scared, okay.
They were really scared. I mean, the period in the late 70s and early 80s when inflation was really getting out of hand is very comparable in a psychological sense to what we've gone through in the last 2 years, in the sense that people could not see the future. They feared that the government could not control things, that they feared that the government was dealing with something that they really didn't understand. They didn't, in the late 70s, they didn't know whether their wages and wages would keep up with rising prices. They didn't know whether their savings would be eroded by rising prices. They didn't know how high interest rates were going to go. In the early 1980s, mortgage rates got up to 14-15%. 30-year fixed-rate mortgages got up to, you know, double digits.
I refinanced my house to becoming a real estate investor at 17.5 fixed.
Yeah, and people didn't know whether that was going to continue.
That's right.
There was a great deal of fear and anxiety, and you had public opinion polls showing for the first time in decades that people did not think the future would be better than the past. And as I say, although the details of the triggering mechanisms were different, the fears then and the fears now are not that far removed from each other. That was the first thing, the way you would describe what was going on then. And I argue in the book, and I believe, obviously, that the inflation and the fear, anxiety, and pessimism that it induced was the main reason Ronald Reagan was elected as president in 1980. The people were not voting for a conservative versus a liberal. They were simply voting for somebody who might do something about it. They didn't know whether Reagan could do it, but they certainly knew that Carter couldn't. And as a result, it was basically, if you don't like the team that's on the field, you vote for another team. And that's what they did. They voted for Reagan.
And in a way, they kind of gave him permission or a mandate to say, okay, we're going to listen to something new. And Volcker coming along just before that, he was, I guess they were just the right pair of people to pull this off.
That is my view. Volcker and Reagan were never close personally. Volcker, again, for your listeners who may not remember, was chairman of the Federal Reserve Board at the end of the 70s. He was picked by Carter, but only because Carter had to take the then head of the Federal Reserve Board and make him Treasury Secretary, because he had fired the Treasury Secretary, and he couldn't find anybody who would take the job, so he took the head of the Fed and made him Treasury Secretary. And then he couldn't find anybody to take the job of heading the Fed except for Volcker, who was at that point the head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. Volcker and Reagan shared one very strong conviction, and that is a common belief that the country could not prosper with double-digit inflation. And Volcker put the economy into a vice, and he basically squeezed it and said, we're just not going to pump out the kind of money and credit that's going to permit this inflation to continue. And interest rates rose sharply. The money supply, although there were aberrations, began to slow down. And the economy went into just a horrific recession that was worse than anything that had existed since World War II. As I mentioned earlier, the unemployment rate went to 10.8%. And Reagan did something that no other politician, in my view, in either party, would have done. He supported Volcker because Reagan believed, like Volcker, that the country could not really thrive if inflation was consistently out of control. And so he let Volcker do this. Reagan's popularity plummeted, and at the low point, it was well below 40%. It was in the mid-30s. But Reagan persisted because he thought Volcker was doing the right thing, and he thought it was essential to do, even as harmful and as hurtful as it was. And so I think that this duo, who had this informal alliance, and who were not close personally, really were the architects of the most important and successful change in economic policy probably since World War II.
One of the other lines that you wrote in the book, it says, what was unique about Volcker and Reagan, about their policy, was all of the adverse consequences were up front.
Absolutely. I mean, no politician likes unemployment rising. No politician likes to have the nightly news filled with stories about the unemployed, about businesses shutting down, about bankruptcies, and people just going out there and expressing their fears of when is this going to end, how bad is it going to be. So almost anybody who might have been elected president in either party, in my view, would have basically come, they first privately told Volcker, you cannot continue this policy. It's just too damaging. And if Volcker had not relented then, I think that they would have come out publicly and said the same thing. And if Volcker and the Fed had still not relented, they would have, I think the president would have endorsed legislation to change the nature of the Federal Reserve System so that it was more accountable to its political masters as opposed to having a kind of independence, which it enjoys to this day.
Robert, we have to end this segment, and this has been a fascinating discussion. I encourage people to get The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Influence, written by Robert Samuelson. Robert, we'll join you on our next segment. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.